My name is Peter Korevaar. It's a Dutch name. I studied in the Netherlands and I was born there. I did a PhD in astronomy and physics, and then I moved to Germany already in 1989 with my wife and two young children. And then we lived in Germany since then, got three more children and seven grandchildren, and had a lot of foster children, but still I was able to do some work. And also I was able to continue my interest in science. And therefore I'm now in the science network, and I've been giving a talk this morning in the network, but of course in the network you are only allowed if you are in the network. And therefore it was a good idea that we also do the same talk as a workshop, so that everybody from all the other networks can also join in if you are interested in this topic. So what is it about? There are very good arguments from cosmology, which is the study of the universe as a whole, that actually point to a creator. And as we will find out in this talk, it is actually a very strong case that we have there. And there are lots of arguments there that people normally do not think about. So I hope you come with me and you can follow it, even if you are not a natural scientist. And I hope the arguments will still be explainable and in a way that you really can take something with you after the workshop. So what we will look at is at three different arguments and the counter arguments. The first argument will be the Kalam cosmological argument. And for every argument that I give, that is actually an argument for a creator, we will also look at how do people work with this evidence, with this scientific request, if you are not believing that there is a God. How do you answer that question? So we look at it from both sides. The second thing that we will look at is at the highly fine-tuned laws of physics in the universe. That's the topic which is called here, a universe designed with us in mind. And then the third part we will look at is that also the universe has a high amount of order that is not simply explainable, which is another sign for a creator. And we also looked here at how materialistic worldviews look at this and try to solve this issue. So let's start with the so-called Kalam cosmological argument. This is an argument which is actually a cause and effect argument. It's a very simple one. If there is a chicken, there must have been an egg before. If there is an egg, there must have been a chicken before. And you can go down the row and you ask, well, where did that ever start? How did that ever happen? And so what you are looking for is a first cause, a first mover. And the Kalam argument goes very simple, actually, in three steps. It says, whatever begins to exist has a cause. Now, the universe began to exist. So, if both of these statements are true, then the universe must have a cause. And around this argument, a lot of philosophical debates have been going on in the past. So that's why it's worth looking into this argument. Historically, it started off already by Aristotle, who said, okay, there must be something like a prime mover. We cannot simply imagine that everything already always existed. A prime mover must be there. He did not call it God, but he realized that there must be a beginning somewhere and somebody set everything into motion. That's how he called it. In the 6th century, we already had theologians looking into this. They didn't call it the same, but they look into this argument, and they looked indeed to the impossibility of going back into the past for infinity. They said, that's not possible, so there must be a beginning. That was the type of argument they had. In the medieval centuries, actually, as Islamic scholasticism, that so-called Kalam, that's where the name of the argument comes from, they started to refine the argument and work on it, because they have, in that respect, have the same issue that we have as Christians. What is the proof that a God exists? And this then was taken over in the 13th century by, for instance, Thomas von Aquin. And the main dispute that they actually had was, is the universe eternal or not? That was a philosophical dispute, because they had no proof or evidence for a beginning of the universe. So they really were discussing it from a philosophical background. Now, this idea of having an eternal universe or a static, non-changing universe, that was seriously considered till recent times. So even Immanuel Kant, he looked at it from both sides. He said, okay, there are very good reasons to say that the universe must have a beginning. But he also saw the argumentation that the universe probably has no beginning, and he was not able to decide, and he left it open. Then in the 20th century, William Lane Craig, he revived, you could say, the Kalam argument. He wrote a book, The Kalam Cosmological Argument, where he actually brought together all the argumentation around this argument, and he not only elaborated on the premises for the argument, if the universe has a beginning, and a thing that begins must have a cause, but he also looked what it then means, what kind of a cause is that, and he came to the conclusion that it must be God. And therefore, he worked really in detail on that. It's a known philosopher. I think many of you will know the name of William Craig. He worked on that. And that Kalam cosmological argument was then significantly strengthened when it was observed that the universe is expanding and therefore somehow must have had a beginning. So the question, did the universe begin or not, actually got answered by astronomy and by observations, which was not the case before. Now, let's first look at the first premise. Whatever begins to exist has a cause. Now, if you ask you or me simply, what do you think? Is that true or not? Everybody say, yeah, of course. What else? It looks like a no-brainer. But philosophically and scientifically, there have been criticism against this simple argument. And therefore, we look a little bit further into it. Why do we think that everything that begins to exist must have a cause? And I now here follow William Lane Craig. There are newer books about it that go deeper into it, but I think for the purpose of this workshop, that is perfectly fine to stay there. The first thing is the rational intuition that we all have. We all say, yeah, sure, if something begins to exist, there was a cause for that. The second thing is inductive reasoning, we call it, because with any experiment that we do, with all the evidence that we find in nature, in the world, and in our own lives, we actually continuously get that this is verified and never falsified. So we get more and more convinced that it is the case because we see no other thing happen. You can also look at it from the other side. What if that would not be true? Then it would mean that things become into existence without a cause. And then the question could be, why don't we see that happening all the time around us, if that would be possible? So that is actually reversing the argument by saying, we don't see it happen, okay? So this is the line of reasoning that is typically used, and actually most people will agree, no matter whether they are Christians or not, that this indeed is a true statement. Now the second one is the universe began to exist. There are actually both scientific and philosophical evidences for this one. The scientific one is the following. First of all, we have the standard model of cosmology that is currently believed by or studied by many of the cosmologists in this world. And so they typically all believe that that happened. There was something like a Big Bang in the beginning, and from that the universe expanded. Now, for this argument, it is not important whether I believe that as a Christian or not. Here it is important that everybody today agrees that the universe had a beginning. No matter whether you believe in God, that you say he created it, so it had a beginning, like the Bible said, or whether you come from cosmology and look at the Big Bang theory, you come to the same conclusion. So everybody says, yeah, it has a beginning. Now, at the time that this was discovered, it was actually, people were thinking differently. They were thinking that probably the universe may be eternal. And even Albert Einstein, he himself was not very happy when this was found, that the universe is expanding and thus showing that it had a beginning. He tried to get rid of that by the so-called cosmological constant. We come back to that later. And he tried to avoid that conclusion. So it was revolutionary thinking 100 years ago that the universe has a beginning. Now today everybody believes that. There is another argument that also comes from science for this. That is the so-called second law of thermodynamics. That is saying that the disorder in a system always increases and never decreases. Now if the universe will be eternal, then the disorder should already, since eternal time, have been increased and increased and increased, and therefore we would have only chaos left, I would say. And no structure, no order, no nice things like stars and galaxies and life would exist anymore. And that is not the case, obviously. Therefore, you can conclude in reverse that there was a beginning and it was not there forever since now. So these are two scientific arguments. There is also philosophical reasoning for the fact that the universe has a beginning. And this is related to the fact that in real life, you cannot have something that is infinite. As a mathematician, you can talk about infinity. We all did that at school. But does in reality infinity also exist or not? That is a good question. And one of the arguments against this is the so-called Hilbert Hotel. One of you or some of you may have heard about that. That's the following idea. Imagine we have a hotel, like the big one here, but it has even more rooms. It has infinite number of rooms. And now all the rooms are full. Okay, and now somebody comes and says, oh, I want a room. The receptionist says, no problem at all. I move the person in room one to room two, from two to three, from three to four. I just move them up all by one room. Then the first room is free and you can get in. Okay, then suddenly, an infinite number of people come and want to have a room. They say, no problem at all. I move person one to room two, from two to four, from four to six, from six to eight, and so on. So I actually empty every second room, move them all out, because there is an infinite number of rooms. And then I also have an infinite number of rooms open, so they can all fit in. And you see that something is going wrong there. In your imagination, you can talk about this type of infinity and have fun about it, but in reality, you cannot imagine that such a thing exists. And this argument has often been used also in the past when they did not know that the universe was beginning to explain why the universe must have a beginning and cannot be eternal. So now we have looked at both premises very briefly, but we have seen them. And then the final conclusion is then, okay, then the universe must have a cause. Now, William Lane Craig, in his book, he started to look into what kind of properties does this cause then have. And the first thing he said, well, it must be a supernatural cause. That's clear, because if it is a natural cause, it will be part of the universe. But the universe is not there. It is created, or it is somehow became into existence, so it must be a supernatural cause. Then this cause also must be outside of space and time, because space and time are part of the universe. They are inherent properties of the universe. If that not exists, then also space and time does not exist. So this supernatural cause must be timeless, spaceless, and he also must be immaterial, because matter is also something that is then part of the universe. And further, it must be enormously powerful. If you can create something like a universe, that is really a lot of power that you need for that. Now then, William Craig reasons that only minds and abstract objects, they are immaterial and timeless. For instance, logic or numbers or geometrical figures like a triangle or so. Those are things you can imagine that they exist no matter whether there is some real life, yes or no. But abstract objects, of course, they are not powerful, and therefore they cannot create anything. And then as a result, William Craig comes to the conclusion that all these properties together can only be attributed to a creative mind, which is very powerful, which is timeless, which is changeless, which is there from eternity till eternity. And now we suddenly recognize these are all descriptions that only can be attributed to God. So this is how he comes to the conclusion from this argument that God exists. Now, this all sounds very profound, very, very proper. So if I'm not a believer, what am I going to do about this? Am I now saying, oh, then I need to believe in God. There is no other option left. Well, you can imagine they don't do that. So how do they argue? What kind of solution do they find? And the solution that they have for this problem of the beginning of the universe is called vacuum fluctuation. Now, anybody heard about on that? I'm not going to ask you to explain it, but just to see. Okay, not many of you have heard of that. So let me explain that it is. Vacuum fluctuation, I think we all know what a vacuum is. It's like empty space, no material in there. And for us, an empty space is like nothing, okay? So if you can get matter out of an empty space, you would actually create something from nothing. That's what you would expect. Now, if you look at quantum field theory, which is a complex physical theory, but it is a true theory, it is not a hypothesis, it's something that has been proven. On a subatomic level, indeed it is possible that in a vacuum, particles are spontaneously generated by energy conversion, and suddenly particles pop up and they disappear again. So, wow, okay, so we have the possibility of generating particles out of a vacuum. That is great. So if that vacuum is fluctuating on a quantum level, maybe sometimes it even fluctuates a little bit more, a whole lot more, and suddenly a universe pops out of that. And then we have a universe out of nothing. That's what the quantum vacuum theory is about. The question is, does this explain it? So is this a good alternative explanation for the beginning of the universe? Let's have a look further into this. On this picture here on the right side, you see how people imagine this, a very simple picture. So you have this empty space, you have these fluctuations of small variations in the energy of the vacuum, and then suddenly a universe pops up and starts to expand. Now, you may have heard me say the energy of the vacuum. That is interesting. This vacuum actually is not empty. It's only empty in the sense that there is no matter in it, but it is a highly energetic vacuum. And this is what the quantum field theory actually also needs. In order to have these particles to be spontaneously produced, you need a very high energy on the vacuum. And this is currently accepted by physics, that the vacuum is not a real vacuum, it is having high energy. They also assume that the laws of nature, the laws of physics that actually explain how this vacuum works and how then gravity works and how electrodynamics works, all of these laws already exist because they start working as soon as this happens. They also assume that somehow space and time already exist because they say sometime in the past, in the vacuum, this suddenly happened, okay? That means that they actually assume the existence of a whole lot of things and not of nothing. That means that this explanation, if you would take it as an explanation, actually reactivates an internal reality through the back door. So they say the universe has a beginning, but this reality has been there forever. And then you can ask the question, where does the vacuum energy come from? Where do the laws of nature come from? Where does space and time come from? And you actually have just postponed the question back in time, and you still have the same issue, where does that all come from? Now, I did ask that question to ChatGPT, because in ChatGPT, they have access to a lot of literature, a lot of books, a lot of information. So I think if somebody came up with a good answer for it, it should find it and actually present it to me. So I asked, where does the vacuum come from? And the answer was, we can describe how it behaves, but not why it exists. That means that there is no explanation for it. It's just, it was there. And that does not really explain it. That means that this materialistic hypothesis is mentioned all the time, but there is no real explanation for it. Okay, and this is how people then think it might look like. You have an empty space and suddenly things pop up. Now, in order for you not to get fall asleep by this picture, I will move on to the next one. Okay, a universe designed with us in mind. What is this about? Now, if you look at the universe, and I think you all have seen beautiful pictures of our universe, this is a part of our own galaxy with a lot of stars, and you also see this beautiful structure in the middle. It's a supernova remnant, so a star that had exploded in the past, and now this is what is left over of the star. Looks beautiful. You may even say it looks like an eye. And a lot of people, they think that somehow the universe is like intelligent or has a mind or has something in mind. That's how many people think if they are not believing in God. So the question is, what about this argument going into the specifics of the universe? And there are a lot of things very interesting here. We are talking here about what we call the so-called entropic principle, that there is fine-tuning in the universe everywhere. And with fine-tuning, I mean now the laws of physics. The laws of physics are such that everything actually is leading to a beautiful universe that we have, and it could look completely different. We see that in a minute. And therefore, you may ask the question, why does it look so brilliant, and why does it just be dark without any light, or why is there matter at all in the universe, and things like that. And the more astronomers and cosmologists realized this fine-tuning, the more actually they were like, hey, where does this come from? How can we explain that? Freeman Dyson had the following statement. As we look out into the universe and identify the many accidents of physics, he called it accidents, and astronomy that have worked together to fit to our benefit, it almost seems, as if the universe must in some sense have known that we were coming. What he means is that everything seemed to prepare for life, not only on Earth, but in the whole universe. Everything fits together. So let's have a look at that. What does that really mean? This so-called entropic principle is the following statement, a very simple statement actually. The universe appears fine-tuned for life. But is that surprising? Because we are here to observe it. So the reasoning is, okay, if the universe would be different, then of course life could not exist in the universe and we would not be able to see it. So therefore we need not to wonder about it. Now this is a little bit easy. And we will see in a minute that you cannot argue that way. But this entropic principle has come up in the last century. In 1974, it was first mentioned as a principle by B. Carter. And then later it was found that also Dicke, another astronomer, already talked about this, but using different terms in 1957, realizing that a lot of things in the universe are fine-tuned. It really became known, this argument, by this book. I have one here of Barrow and Tipler, The Entropic Cosmological Principle. And in this book, you will find many, many, many things that are very special on the Earth, in our solar system, in our surrounding, in the galaxy, in the universe as a whole. This book is really very nice to read because there are so many things that you never think of that all seem to fit together so that life can exist in the universe. And this book got discussed very much among astronomers. It came out, as you see here, in 1986. I finished my PhD in astronomy in 1988, 2 years later. And I got this book as a gift present from my other colleagues at the university. They say, okay, we know that you believe in God. Here is an interesting book for you. You may like it. And my answer was, it may be interesting for you as well to read it, because all these arguments actually tell you the universe is not just random. It is very, very, very special. And this actually, of course, is a pointer to, hey, there is a creator that knew exactly what he did when he created all of that, because we are living in it. And that's possible because he did it. But of course, that's a conclusion that is far-reaching. And the question is, can you also interpret it in a different way? We'll look at that in a minute. This entropic principle comes in two main versions. The first one is the weak entropic principle, which simply states, okay, the universe is such that we can live in it. So it's not really like a proof, or it's just a statement. It's like an observation that you make. And not saying why it is the case. There is also a strong version of this principle that said the universe must allow observers to exist. Now, if you state it in that way, why should the universe, why should there be a must? And that actually goes into the direction that the universe is now something like a minded universe. It has an intention. It has a target to actually create life. And this, of course, goes much beyond the pure observation of fine-tuning, because now it's an interpretation that the universe is intelligent. And the two authors of this book, actually, in the end of their book, they go into this direction, and they later wrote another book where they elaborate on that. So they are followers of this strong entropic principle, and they argue for the intelligent universe. Now, I do not think the universe is intelligent. I think the creator is intelligent. That's a different thing, of course. But the the arguments that lead people to think this way, they are very valid. And they really make us think, okay, what did God do in order to make this all happen so that we can live in it? Now, cosmologists, they do not like this principle. And you can imagine why that is the case, because they need to then interpret why everything is so highly fine-tuned, and they have no explanation for that. So therefore, they always try to somehow neglect it or diminish it, or like in this paper, this scientific paper last year, with the simple title, Falsifying Entropics. So they say, we have now a way to actually prove that this entropic principle is not working. And if you look into this article, then actually you see that they are talking only about a very tiny thing about fine-tuning. They are not talking about all the fine-tuning, but a very minor part of it. And then they say, well, we probably have a way to disprove that. I'm not going into the detail here. That would take too long, and it's also not necessary. But what you see the thinking of the cosmologist. If he can find something that disproves the fine-tuning, then we are happy, okay? Because we don't want that. Now, there is whole lot of things that are fine-tuned in the universe. It will be simply too long to put up the whole list. I just put up a few here. And just even without being a physicist, you can imagine that the gravitational force that keeps matter together and the electrodynamic force that actually you know there is a attracting version and a distracting version of that is positive and negative charges, that those forces are in very perfect balance. If that would not be the case, for instance, stars could not exist, as an example. We would have no light in the universe. And that's just one example. Many more examples are there with the other forces on the atomic level. You know that an atom consists of a nucleus and the electrons around it. Now, if those forces that keep that together would be a bit different, then atoms could not exist, or they would be unstable and just fall apart. And then, of course, we would not have matter in the universe. And all these type of things. So there are a lot of these type of fine-tunings there. And one very interesting one is the so-called cosmological constant here. That's a very extremely high-tuned value. If it would just be a little tiny bit different, then actually we already would have a big problem with the universe, that it would not be able to contain life. And this cosmological constant is actually a result of of Einstein's theory of gravity. And he already introduced that when he launched his theory. He was always talking, does it exist or not exist? And only in recent years, it was found that indeed there is something like this cosmological constant, because people found out that the universe is not only expanding, but that the expansion of the universe is even getting faster and faster. So it's an accelerated expansion. And this can only be interpreted in this way by a cosmological constant. Now, the question is, how large is that constant? And the funny thing is that actually the theory about this cosmological constant coming from quantum field zero-point energy would actually suggest that the number must be the lower number here, 10 to the plus 71 gigaelectron volt to the power of 4, and that is a very large number. Now, the number which is really measured in reality for the acceleration of the universe is the number above there, 10 to the minus 47. This is 10 to the 120 apart from each other. So this is so huge difference. And that means that it's a very highly fine-tuned number that actually it has been described as the worst theoretical prediction in the history of physics. Because the theory tells us something completely different from what we really find. And that means that it is a highly fine-tuned exact number that drives our universe. So this is a fine-tuning problem, which would just be a tiny bit larger than the universe would expand so quickly that actually galaxies and stars would not be able to exist. But if it would be smaller and negative, then actually the universe would not expand at all. It would expand a little bit and then just crash in together. So, but both is not happening, and therefore we need this precise fine-tuned value so that it actually behaves the way it does. So then how do you explain it if you do not say, well, it was God who knew exactly which number he needed in order to have the universe such as it is? It could be easily different, And why is that not the case? And then we come up with the so-called multiverse hypothesis. And Steven Weinberg, also a famous cosmologist in 1987, he already said, okay, the only explanation for this very, very small value of this cosmological constant can only be explained by a multiverse. Now, what is a multiverse? Multiverse is another word for many universes. The so-called multiverse theory, and actually there are various versions of it, says that our universe that we observe is not the only universe. There are other universes. And not a few, there are many, 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 some say even almost infinite number of other universes. Now, how do people come to that conclusion? Because there is no physical theory that tells us there must be another universe. The only reason is the following. The fine-tuning of the constants of physics are now explained by the reasoning that if there are many, many other universes, and all of them have different sets of constants of nature, then the chance that in one of those universes all the parameters fit well increases. This is like if you play the lotto and if you are the only one who is playing it, you will never win it. But if more than 100 million people play it, then the chance that one gets the big lottery is increasing. And that's the same here. They assume many universes and then say in a few of them, or maybe only in one, everything fits. And we, of course, need to be in that universe because in all the other we cannot exist. Okay? So they also implicitly assume that if life can exist in such a universe, it will also get into existence by itself. That's the next step, of course. But we don't talk about that step here. We just talk about this multiverse theory. Now, the number of universes that you need to explain or to make our universe probable is a huge number. It says here 10 to the 1,000. That was the biggest number I have read so far in papers. Most of the time, you see something like 10 to the 500, which is still a huge number. It's an amazingly huge number. The number of atomic particles in the whole universe is 10 to the 80. And that gives you an idea of how many universes they need to assume in order to make this plausible. And you can imagine that's quite a lot. Now, you may say, is there any evidence that these universes exist? And that's not the case. That's the funny thing about this. This is an hypothesis. And already, when this hypothesis came up, people start to argue against it. And that was not only Christians that did that. It was also a lot of philosophers and also cosmologists. And one famous example is Paul Davis. And he actually published in the New York Times a brief history of the multiverse in 2003. And he made some interesting statements there about this theory. I said, for a start, how is the existence of the other universes to be tested? And the reason is, you cannot observe them. They are outside of our universe. We cannot even observe the whole universe. So if it's outside, we definitely will not be able to see it or test it. So that is the first point. It's a pure hypothesis. There is no evidence whatever that those things do exist. The second thing is, more and more must be accepted on faith, and less is open to scientific verification. Goes into the same direction. It said, this is not a science anymore. This is a faith. If you want to believe in that, it's okay. But then please say that you are believing in it, and not that it is scientific. And this goes on. And the last remark probably is the best one. The multiverse theory may be dressed up in scientific language, but in a sense, it requires the same leap of faith as a belief in a creator. That means if a scientist that does not believe in God tells you, we don't need God anymore, we have the multiverse, you can say, okay, I only need one God. You need 10 to the 500 universes. Who do you think has the bigger belief out of us? That's a very good argument. And we should use it. You choose it and not always say, oh, science has proven that God does not exist. What am I going to say about that? Okay. So the next one, it's not even finished now. It becomes even better. A highly ordered universe. What is this about? The universe is said to be flat, and it is said to be isotropic, and it's said to be to have a low entropy. Now, these are terms that you may have heard or not have heard. I'm going to explain them. Three things in the universe that are very, very interesting, and there is no good explanation for it, unless you say it was God who did that, because then I can understand why it is the way it is. What is this about? What we have seen so far is that the constants of physics are fine-tuned, allowing matter, light, and stars to exist. But even then, if you have the perfect laws of nature and everything is working fine, still the universe looks not at what you expect if it simply randomly came into existence by a Big Bang that started to produce stars and galaxies. You would expect something completely different. And that is because you would not expect the universe to be flat. You would not expect it to be isotropic and not to have the highly ordered structure in the universe. So let's have a look at those. Before of that, I just show a little bit of this very nice universe, very nice structure that we have there. Here we have a region of trunks of gas and dust in our own galaxy. It's not so far away. You see here 7,000 light years. In astronomical terms, that is around the corner, okay? It's our neighbor, more or less. This is a region where a lot of star formation today takes place. That's why they call it the pillars of creation, because stars are actually born there. We have here another galaxy outside of our Milky Way, so that's a bit further away, 2.5 million light years away. It's the Andromeda galaxy. Earlier, it was called Andromeda Nebula, because in the first times that they saw it, they were not able to resolve and see that these are all stars. They thought it was just like a cloud of gas or something like that. Then it turned out to be a whole galaxy outside of our own galaxy. And here we see an interesting picture. You will say, oh, how so many stars? Now there are hardly any stars here. There is only a few stars here, and all the others are galaxies. And the galaxy is an island of stars containing up to 100 billion stars. Each of those that you see here. It's a so-called deep field image of the Hubble telescope. And then we start to realize that this universe is not only huge, but also has a very rich structure and a lot of information in there. So let's now have a look at this structure. What are the problems that we have here and that need to be solved by cosmology and that actually point to a creator if you look into it? The first is what we call the flatness problem. What is this? Now, I already said that the universe could either expand and then collapse again. It could also expand and then expand faster, so fast that actually no galaxies and stars could form. And in between of those possibilities, you have the, let's say, a normal slow expansion, but everything is fine for the formation of stars and galaxies or for the existence of stars and galaxies at all. And this is what we call a flat universe, if it is exactly between the two extremes. Now, and it's found that this is related to the energy and matter density of the universe. So if there is more matter in the universe, it actually collapses. If there is less matter, it expands too fast. And it is found today that the difference from this critical density to the real density is very, very small. It's less than 1%. So we are very close to this border. And that's why they call it a flat universe. Now, the interesting thing is, if you go now backward in time, in the history of time, when you go further back in time, it must be even closer to that. Because this is a thing that actually goes apart over time. And if it's only 1% now, it must be much less than 1% in the past. We see some numbers here. For instance, when the universe was only a couple of thousand years old, then already we are at an accuracy of less than 1,000, one in 1,000. But if you go back to to what we call the Big Bang time, no matter if it happened or not, but if you believe that the Big Bang happened, then you need to assume that this was as accurate as 1 to the 10 to the 60. So one part in 10 to the 60 deviation would already cause more than 1% now. And that actually means that it is a very highly fine-tuned value, the amount of energy and matter in the universe, and there must be an explanation for this, because that cannot be done randomly. Another problem, which has a similar implication, is the so-called horizon problem. If you look in the sky with our telescopes, And we see that there is a radiation there. It's so-called cosmic microwave background radiation. It's a radiation coming to all of us, but we can't see it because it has a very low temperature. But it can be measured by radio telescopes. And they find that this comes from all directions, and it is supposed to be a remnant of this Big Bang. But what the problem with it is that it is a very, very precise value from all directions. They all have the same intensity. And this is what you would not expect if a Big Bang happens. You would expect that there is much more fluctuation in this, and not the very small fluctuations that we have today. So the fluctuation that we find here is only one in 100,000 variation. And that means that it's very isotropic. Isotropic means from all directions you get the same value. And this map that you see here is actually like a picture of the sky mapped to a two-dimensional structure, but of course it's a sphere. And the colors indicate the deviations from the average. And they have to exaggerate very highly to find those differences of less than 10 to the minus 5. So very small differences are found there. So this is another problem. How can that be? And in the Big Bang, you would expect much larger differences. And they do not know where that comes from. And then there is that third problem that is with the entropy in the universe. What does that mean? Now, entropy is a word that means the amount of order in a system. If a system has a low entropy, that means it has it's very highly ordered. If it has a high entropy, then actually the disorder increases and the order decreases. And we all know that if you have something nice in your hand and you throw it up in the air and you drop it down, then you just get random pieces destroyed over the... You do not expect that the same thing that you had in your hand comes back exactly as you threw it up, or maybe even better, structured. The structure actually decreases and does not increase. And this means that what we found in the universe is very highly structured. Matter is highly structured, stars are highly structured, galaxies are, also the life on Earth. Everything is highly structured. And this means that in the beginning, however long ago that was, the structure was even higher than it is today, because it has decreased since then. So Roger Penrose, a famous physicist, he got the Nobel Prize in 2020. He actually has written a book. It's a very interesting book, The Road to Reality. It's a cosmological book, and if you want to know everything about cosmology, you can read the book, but you need to be quite knowledgeable in physics because it's not easy to read. But in this book, he made an astonishing statement about the entropy of the universe, so about the amount of order. He said the chance that the order of the universe was so high that we can observe the universe as it is today is 10 to the power 10 to the power 123. Which actually means impossible, okay? This is really impossible. And therefore, there must be somehow an explanation for all these things. Why is it so flat? Why is it so isotropic? Why do we have this high order in the universe? All big questions for cosmology and difficult questions to answer. Now, my answer will be yes, God knew exactly what we need. What is needed for the universe so that we can live in it. And he created this for us. We can read it in Jesaja, for instance, 43. He made it so that we can live on it. But if you don't believe that, you have to find an explanation for all of this, and you have an issue there. So how do cosmologists today interpret this and actually find a solution for this? I think some of you must have seen this picture somewhere in the past or in your books or whatever. It's a nice picture that tries to put in one picture how people today think that the Big Bang occurred and then how the universe developed. And you see it starts on the left with quantum fluctuations. We talked about it now. So that the start of the universe is supposed to be a quantum fluctuation. Although there are these many problems with that, it's still stated. They have no other explanation, so it must have been a quantum fluctuation. And then you see after that we have a period which is called inflation. And inflation is a very interesting theory that the universe, after it came into existence, whatever the cause was, it must have expanded very rapidly over a very short period of time in order to stretch it out and make it flat. So because if you do that, then actually you get an energy density that is very close to this critical density. And that's exactly what we find today. And also it becomes isotropic. So you have this radiation the same in all directions if you do this stretching. And this became clear already quite soon in 1980, I think it was first launched. And therefore today all cosmologists believe that this inflation took place. And from there on then the universe developed further. I will not go into all the details here, but what we have now is, what about this inflation? Alan Guth in 1981 proposed this, and in the meantime all cosmologists believe in it. It suggests that the universe went through a brief period of exponential expansion directly after the Big Bang. And they talk about an expansion factor of 10 to the 26 in a very short period of time. Now, what does 10 to the 26 mean? If you look at that number, you say, well, 10 to 26, we have seen larger number before, maybe it's not a large number. Now, let's imagine the universe at that time would be as large as a marble, 1 centimeter in. That's not a big universe, is it? Now, if I blow it up by a factor of 10 to the 26 in a very short period of time, it suddenly has the size of 1,000 times the Milky Way. Okay? So this is 10 to the 26. So it is an enormous inflation, an enormous expansion. By the way, in God's Word, we read something about that God expanded the universe in the first book of Genesis. And a lot of Christian believers, they say, well, this is exactly what God was talking about there. I'm not sure whether that's the case. I have a different opinion, but I can imagine that people say that. But at least today, cosmologists need this inflation. Now, what's wrong about that? The only thing which is wrong about it, there is no evidence soever for a physical mechanism that causes this. So it's like a miracle. The inflation lacks direct experimental evidence of its mechanism. The required inflation field has never been directly observed, so the inflation can explain, if it occurred, it would explain the flatness and horizon problems. And therefore it's generally accepted today by cosmologists. But no physical theory exists that explains how that works. And that we need to be clear of, that here we're talking about things that are not existing in theory, it's only in the minds of the people that want to have it. Now, what about this final problem that we had? The final problem was about the low entropy of the universe, the high order of the universe. And there also cosmologists have been thinking, how can we explain that? And there will be no time and also, I think, no need. There is a number of theories that have been brought forward for that. And two of those theories actually come by Roger Penrose himself, who brought up this argument himself. He also thought, I need to find a solution for that. But he admits himself that they are not no satisfactory theories. They are not a theory at all. It's a hypothesis. It's a thinking of how it could have been without any proof that it is true. That means that there is currently, in cosmology, there is no solution for this problem. We have this high order, and we have no idea where it comes from, if we do not believe that God created it like that. So far, so good. So what is then the final case for a creator that we have here? If we look on Earth, not in the universe, and see a beautiful picture like this, you say, okay, did that all came into existence by chance or not? And what we have seen here is that we have seen a lot of arguments from cosmology, and one of the most famous cosmologists was Steven Weinberg. He was one of the first to put up this multiverse theory. He is an atheist. He clearly says he does not believe that there is God. But now he needs to explain all these things. And he wrote a quite famous book, The First 3 Minutes, where he explains how the Big Bang worked and what happened in the first 3 minutes, because a lot of things happened according to the Big Bang theory during that time. And then at the end of this book, he writes a few things that are very interesting. Because then he starts reflecting on this and he said, okay, now in my mind at least I have explained how everything works. I know what the Big Bang is. I know what happened there. But what does that mean for me, for my life, for the meaning of life? And then he writes, As I write this, I happen to be in an aeroplane at 30,000 feet flying over Wyoming and en route from San Francisco to Boston. Below, the earth looks very soft and comfortably fluffy clouds here and there. Snow turning pink as the sun sets, roads stretching straight across the country from one town to another. And then he said, it is very hard to realize that this is just all a tiny part of an overwhelmingly hostile universe. And he continues with that. And also on the next page, he then says, okay, the only thing for me that makes it reasonable is that I, as a scientist, now understand how it all works. That is the meaning of life for him. And what you see there is that actually, if you stay with the natural materialism explanations of all this, or ideas of all this, in the end, you get into a nihilistic view of the world, because there is no meaning at all. There is no meaning of life. There is no intention. There is no, it's all blind force, and it ends simply in darkness, and that's all what happens. We have seen that actually those natural sciences, they make a very strong case for God. There are so many arguments that actually lead into the direction of here is something at work, here is someone at work, a creative mind that knew exactly what he did, and therefore all these things fit nicely together, and then you can understand it. We have looked at the arguments from cosmology, the three arguments that I mentioned, the Kalam argument, the fine-tuning, and the structure and order of the universe, but there are many more arguments. Some come directly from astronomy, for instance, the properties of the Earth, the properties of the sun, the position of the Earth in the solar system, a lot of in that area as well. That will be another workshop, maybe next year. And then we have also a lot of arguments, sometimes even better arguments from biology. We have the fact that the origin of life cannot be explained by mere chance. There is no way you can do that. Whatever they teach you in school, that people have understand how life came into existence, forget it. It's only in the thoughts of the scientist that they said it must have been like that. No proof, no evidence whatsoever. The same is true for complexity that we find in the cells of animals, and we have irreducible complexity there, so-called molecular machines, amazing stuff. We have a lot of information in the DNA, in our own DNA, that cannot just get there by accident. And we have engineering wonders in the animal world, a lot of them, all pointing to a creator. And there is an interesting book, I don't have it with me, but it can be downloaded as a PDF if you want to have it. Just look at The Case for a Creator by Lee Strobel as a PDF, and then you will find it somewhere. It's on different sites. You can download it. And what Lee Strobel, you may know the name, he has written the book The Case for Christ. He was a journalist, and he was not a believer, and his wife actually became a believer, and he wanted to prove for his wife this is all nonsense, and he started to study this whole stuff, and actually he became a believer himself, and then he wrote this, he wrote this book, The Case for Christ, and then later he also wrote this book, The Case for a Creator, and he brings very nicely together all these arguments in one book, from astronomy, from biology, from other disciplines of natural scientists. And he does that in the form of interviews. And it's very good to read, even if you are not a scientist. So therefore, I recommend this book. And still, he brings all these arguments to a point. So some of the arguments I mentioned, you will find there in the chapters 5 and 6, the evidence from cosmology, beginning with a Big Bang, the interview with William Lane Craig. Lists actually all the arguments that I've been giving in the talk as an example. And there are much more in this book, so it's a real good recommendation to buy that book if you are interested in it. Now, why do people not believe in God, although they see all this? And actually, we know that what happens, they are blind. And that's also something that for us, as people from the ELF, we should actually go out and tell people, you can believe in God. There is no need to say there is no creator. That is not scientific. It is scientific to say all evidence points to a creator. That is scientific. And since the creation of the world, Paul says in Romans, God's invisible qualities, his internal power and divine nature, they have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that people are without excuse. Although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him. Their thinking became futile and their foolish hearts were darkened. Although they claimed to be wise, they became fools. That is really what happens. And therefore, only God himself can change them. But we can give them arguments and we can give them good reasons for changing their minds.